Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 19, Ethics and Education Research with Dr. Lisa Reed.
Welcome back, everyone, to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a guest who is joining us down the line, Tom, who you actually met at a conference.
Yes, I found us a guest. I went to the Scottish Education Research Association conference up in Edinburgh, where I found Dr. Lisa Reed, who works at the University of Dundee, but is actually joining us down the line today from Carlisle. Hello, Dr. Lisa Reed.
Hello, great to be here.
Nice to chat to you again. We had some lovely chats when I met you up in Edinburgh. You're here to talk about the messiness of ethical matters when you're researching as a practitioner researcher. But before we dive into the kind of detail of that, why don't you tell us and our listeners a little bit about how you came to be working in the University of Dundee and what it is that you do?
Okay, so I'm a lecturer up at Dundee. I lecture in education across the undergraduate, the postgraduate and the master's programmes. I came into teaching 20 years ago, so when I was 30, and I did it as a career change. It was due to family requires and pressures, and I was had a high pressure job, and I moved over into teaching thinking that that would be much more family friendly. And after about sort of 5 or 6 years, I started a master's online, and there that really opened up my understanding around education as being a discipline in itself. And that kind of started my journey towards understanding and researching education as a topic on its own, rather than thinking about the science curriculum, which I'd done an awful lot about previously because I was a science teacher. And kind of fast forward sort of 20 years, I'm now up at Dundee as a lecturer in education. I finished my PhD 3 years ago and have been studying and researching the world of education and teachers and teaching since then.
And of course, probably like yourselves up there in Scotland, there's a real drive here in Wales towards encouraging and supporting and upskilling teachers in order to conduct their own practitioner research. We've got a national master's in education that they're really encouraging by sort of financially backing teachers in the profession to complete. And so we've potentially got a lot more classroom-based practitioners conducting research. And so when Tom came back fresh from this conference with your slides in hand, as it were, and I saw reconciling ethical dilemmas as a practitioner researcher through use of a reflexive framework as the title, I thought, oh gosh, that's a bit of me and that's a bit of the people I work with. So tell us, how did you come to sort of want to dig in more deeply to this topic? And what do you mean by ethical dilemmas? I'm sure some people have got some ideas, but what brought you to it and what was the problem there that you wanted to address?
This was something that I started to really consider while I was doing my PhD. As a PGR and as a doctoral researcher, completing my ethics in order to be able to do a study across teachers around the geographical area that I was working in, was something that opened my eyes up a lot to the various levels of things and attentions that were needed. So everything around ethics builds upon and is there to make sure that we're avoiding harm, that there's informed consent, we're respecting privacy, that we're avoiding deception. This central core of beneficence is really important, this idea that the benefits of the knowledge that we gained from the research is not going to come at the cost of any harm to our participants. So there was a lot of attention towards that as a procedural aspect in the application process, Once I was out actually in the field and doing my interviews and spending time with the participant teachers that I had recruited, I suddenly found myself in a situation where there was a lot of questions that I needed to ask myself and of myself whilst I was actually gathering the data and spending time with my participant teachers that I hadn't considered when I was doing my application for my ethics approval. And it was that raised some of those questions for me around actually the conducting and the practice of ethics whilst doing research, and the separation as such of that as of completing the ethics application and trying to project forward what that means.
And lots of people who think of research think of it as quite a scientific, quite a cut and dried thing where the person doing the research can float happily above what's going on, observing it and not disturbing it in any way. But we've got more and more people now, haven't we, researching into their own area, their own workplace sometimes, particularly in education, particularly with things like the funded national masters we've got here in Wales now. We've got people who are teachers carrying out research in their place of work. And it gets really messy, doesn't it?
I think so, yes. And I think the issue, especially as a practitioner researcher, that I found myself exposed to was that as a teacher in schools, I'm very aware of the kind of complexity and the political landscape that exists within schools and schooling. And so therefore, to be able to say that I have an objectivity or a neutrality opposed to recognizing those environments was completely inauthentic. The recognition and understanding of those landscapes brings with it an advantage to the research in the sense of knowing what it is to exist within those cultures, but also recognizing that I am in a very privileged position in that I'm being able to actually get an insight into what that looks and lives like for a wider number of people. But that information and that exposure to that comes with it a level of responsibility, and it comes with it a level of responsibility to those participants in that you want their authentic voice, you want and you want them to trust you in terms of the type of research with the type of research that you're doing, but that there is a requirement and understanding, an emotional intelligence, I suppose, a reflexivity that comes from recognizing what it is that's being said and how that information can be best used, and the intentions and the purposes of the participants are maintained in the way that the research evolves and the findings that are then drawn.
And it strikes me that as practitioners, we sort of lean towards these kind of dilemmas when we are thinking about teaching and learning. We start to think, well, how am I going to solve this problem? What tools am I going to need? What am I going to need to do? What qualities do I need to possess in order to ensure that? Because I think the bottom line with ethics is do no harm, isn't it? And I suppose the risks that you've sort of pointed out there, your next step was to go, well, how am I going to, as you say in your title, reconcile some of these issues around ethics in a way that still allows me to gather this data, present it in a way that is authentic, that is true to the participants involved. So how did you go about figuring out what your next steps were?
I think that one of the things, again, just kind of keeping that core aim of, as you said, it's quite simply the do no harm, remained really quite central in every kind of decision making process that I was doing. So, for example, when I was looking at, OK, where was I going to conduct this research? The participants were able to decide themselves where they would like that to happen, so that they had their own agency over their choice of location, that the time of that location within, you know, the boundaries of convenience and ability to travel, etc., was workable, so that the participants had themselves an awful lot of agency within the location of where we were doing interviews. Now, that, of course, is specific for me, because I would be travelling to them and we would be doing a face-to-face discussion. Different types of research designs will have different issues to deal with regards to making sure that the participants feel safe and comfortable in the location that the research is happening. But for me, it was about them having agency over that. This was important because equally with myself going into, for example, a school and going to meet somebody there to have an interview with, there's an awful lot of exposure of that. You know, and if somebody wants to take part in the research but doesn't necessarily want that participation to be widely known, they want to have some control over who's aware of that, for example, then again, having that discussion with them about where best to meet, what's the best thing to do, was an important part of it. Equally, where I'd be looking at getting things like their biographical information, or where I was getting things like where I wanted them to reflect on the research process and the interviews and the questions that we were asking, that actually I didn't need to be there with them for that. And therefore, I could send them over online forms where they could fill out all of that information and send that information over to me, where they could be quite considered and they could do it in their own time. And they didn't need to feel that pressure of me asking them what it was that they wanted to disclose at that particular point. Point in time of the interview. So was able to separate out, okay, what is it that I need that is essential that takes place between the two of us, and what actually could take place separately and just with the participants on their own, in their own time, through an online form, for example.
Just thinking about our audience now, who might include some people who are doing master's research, perhaps while holding down a job as a teacher, very, very busy, probably quite tempted to carry it out in their place of work. And I don't know if this is a controversial thing to say, but I think there are people out there who see ethics as a bit of a box-ticking exercise, or, you know, the preserve of kind of quite geeky people. I wouldn't mind betting there's possibly even a sort of breed of supervisor who will say to students, oh, just get your ethics in, just get it done. And the temptation when you're busy is just whack in a few references to the BERA guidelines and talk about anonymity and get over that hurdle. Obviously, we would never condone that on this podcast, but I think possibly you're a very well-placed person to perhaps say something to those people who might be tempted to just see ethics as a hurdle to get over, or a form to fill in, or a thing to get done as quickly as possible. Why shouldn't they think like that?
Well, I think it goes back to this idea about do no harm. It goes back to the idea of beneficence, but also the fact that we are actually ourselves, you know, humans, and we are doing and want to do research for our own, you know, personal agendas, for example, but that we also recognize that how would we ourselves want to be respected and treated within, if we were to offer ourselves in for doing research. And so considering everything from the point of view of the participant, it just is an important aspect of being human in the research that we are doing. Especially, you know, very specifically, if the research is dealing with very direct contact with the participants in terms of their opinions, perspectives, experience, lived experiences, and so on, which is often very much the focus of qualitative work, because that's in its very nature what it is that we're doing. So the recognition that we're human, they're human, and the benefits of the research and the strength of the research and the data and the richness of the data comes from that relationship between the researcher and the participant. It's one of the really sort of difficult things within qualitative research to really navigate in comparison to quantitative research and certainly the kind of positivist aspects of research design, where the ontological and epistemological aspects of research are very clear and distinct. So what is it that we can know and how we can know it are very clear. When we move into qualitative research, it's very grey, and the distinction line between those two things is very blurred, in that what is it that we can know and how we can know it really coexist. And they coexist between that researcher and that participant at that moment in time. And therefore, the relationship between the participant and the researcher becomes quite central in the information that we're able to gather, the insight that we're able to gather, and the exposure and the understanding of people's perspectives around what their lived experiences look and feel like for them at the time. So that sort of reciprocity between the two is an essential part of actually our ethical positions, in that we respect our participants and we want our participants to trust us, and therefore that comes with an ethical responsibility. So the procedural ethics of applying for ethical approval actually still asks those questions of us. And whilst it can feel like a tick boxing exercise, some of the questions within the ethics form do force us to ask ourselves, what is my research about? What is it that I'm trying to achieve? How am I what participants are going to allow me to do that? And how am I going to protect them? And yet there is a kind of, as you were saying, you know, okay, we've got anonymity, we're going to save all of our data on a, you know, password protected encrypted database server. We're only going to save it for a certain amount of time. Only certain people are going to have access to it. Participants can withdraw. And we're going to make sure that all of that information is available in the participant information sheet, and there's going to be consent forms and so on. But the enacting of that is where the ethics in practice comes in. And it's not separating out the fact that there was an ethical approval process required, but the ethics continues after that approval has been granted, purely because that the harm which can be done is done in practice. And therefore, the attention to ourselves and our ethical positions are essential, because our central premise is do no harm.
Yeah, and something you spoke about at the start struck me, and looking through your slides is something that we need to dig into. That moment that you found that you'd done all the sort of preparatory work, but then when you were in the moment gathering the data, it occurred to you that, you know, ethics was something that you needed to be sort of actively considering as you were gathering that data. And I noticed in your presentation, you've got this idea of active reflexivity within an emancipatory purpose. And I wondered if you could, I think that there might be listeners out there who are quite familiar with being reflective. But I remember when I started working at master's level, reflexivity was something that I think I was doing without knowing it. And I hadn't come across that term. So could you tell us, what is reflexivity and why is that active reflexivity important? Because, of course, sometimes when you're gathering the research, you know that you've got knowledge of the thing that you're discussing with your participants too, which can be a tricky thing to navigate. So I don't know whether you got that question there, but what is reflexivity?
Yeah, no, I absolutely did. And I think it's a really important one. And I'm going to use, a little bit of a kind of analogy in the way that I try and explain my understanding of how I differentiate between what is reflective and what is reflexive. And this actually was one of the very first things that I think I explored when I started my master's 14 years ago. I'm just looking at the time. I had a Facebook reminder about that just recently. And when I think about being reflective, I think about it as in the spelling reflect with the C and thinking about looking in a mirror. And it's about looking at what's at the image that's coming back. It's thinking about what has happened, what's in that past. And when I think about reflexivity with the X, it's like the reflex of going to catch a ball, or somebody's hit you at a certain point in your funny bone and you have a knee-jerk reaction. It's in that moment, it's responding to the fact that the stimulus has come in and you're needing to respond there and then. And the reflexivity and the reflexive framework, you could almost say, are a little bit kind of opposing points, how you can have a framework that deals with a kind of reflexive position. But all of our reflexive actions come from past knowledges. And therefore, it's drawing on, for me, my own understanding and my own awareness of what it is to exist as a teacher, what it is to exist within the school structures and the educational systems and all the politics and the cultures that exist within that. So that when I am with my participants, that there is a recognition and acknowledgement that I understand those pressures. But equally, that I am a researcher and I am looking at exploring those lived experiences with them. And so therefore, for me, when I'm conducting interviews, I try and design them to be conversational. I'm very sensitive to responses and body language. I'm very aware of, you know, sensitive data. I'm very making sure that there's a reiteration around the right for disclosure, the right for withdrawal, the right to be able to say what they feel about their own particular situations in their own particular circumstances. And that the responsiveness comes there from neither encouraging, for example, a particular thing, but equally neither discouraging another. So that the voice of the participants in what it is that they feel for themselves and where they are in response to the things that we are talking about is what remains central in that data that we are generating in that time that we've got together.
Just digging into one of the details of your reflexive ethical framework. You've talked a lot about the participants involved in your research. And I suppose one of the really sort of headline eye-grabbing things about doing education research is that you might have children involved. And obviously, you know, I'm sure pretty much everybody is alive to the ethical considerations of working with young people in schools. You know, we don't want to harm them. We don't want to do anything that's going to upset them or mess up their education. But the bit where you talk about the awareness of the political and cultural situations reminds me that actually, even if you don't get involved with pupils, and in fact, you're a national MA person or a teacher, getting involved with researching with your colleagues in a school, you're not actually out of the woods ethically, are you? In fact, in some ways, it can get even more political and even more tricky.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think that comes back to the question that we were thinking about at the very beginning, in that those ethical dilemmas of being a practitioner researcher. And that when I started my doctoral work, I still very much identified as a teacher. If anybody said to me, what do you do? I'd go, oh, I'm a teacher. And my role and my identity as a researcher was very much attached to my doctoral study and felt very separate. When I started to actually gather my data, when I started to actually spend time with my participants, there I recognized that the kind of practitioner and researcher, again, distinction became really quite blurred. And it became blurred in some ways because a lot of the stories, a lot of the awareness of the examples of the lived experiences were very similar to the fact that, you know, if I was having coffee with some colleagues or if we're listening to kind of staff room chat, some of those things would have already been present. The examples of their experiences were something that, because I'd been in teaching for such a long time, I already had an exposure to. And therefore, the requirement for me to recognize that I suddenly held an important piece of their life history, I suppose, or their experiences, was something that held really, there was quite a lot of responsibility for me that I suddenly recognized that I hadn't anticipated I was going to become exposed to. Because if we go for a chat with our friends and we trust them and we talk about the various things that are happening, all of a sudden these, you know, my participants were people that I was not associated with, that I didn't teach with, that I didn't work with. But all of a sudden, I found myself immersed and recognizing what it was like to live and work in the structures that they were talking about. And I had to be very careful for myself around what that meant for me in terms of what my understanding was around particular schools or particular departments or particular, you know, communities of practice, and so on.
And I wonder now, in your role, do you mentor, work with, supervise your own master's students? And if so, has this sort of affected the advice, the way that you're working with them? I remember being encouraged to go and have a look at the BIRA ethical guidelines, but nothing of this sort of reflexive nature, nothing that went quite as deep as this. So how has this affected your relationship with them? And I suppose if you were to give advice out there to supervisors working with master's students, what would that be?
I think that it has most definitely changed. It certainly made my awareness and thought processes around research design and the ethics that comes even just from that perspective. So when we're thinking about the questions that we're going to ask at interview or the questions that we're going to put into a survey, that not only are they aligned against, for example, the research questions, but that they're also aligned with regards to the rights of the participant in terms of their privacy, in terms of their not being deceptive, that we're recognising that the questions that we're asking will do no harm. And equally then moving it forward into how is this going to disseminate and how is it going to contribute to knowledge and what is it that I've gained through that process. So when I'm supervising not only my PhD and my master's students, there is very much a sense of recognition between, as I talked about, that kind of blurred line between the ontology and epistemology and the qualitative end of the continuum, of recognizing the messiness that exists there. And it exists there because there is very much a relationship between the researcher and the researched. And therefore, what you can know exists in how you are able to know it through your participants. And that is where the ethics and the dilemmas in that ethics exist, of making sure that the participants are at the core of your decision-making process with regards to the questions that you're asking, the type of information that you're gathering, and how you plan to analyze and disseminate that out into the future.
And thinking about that, imagining a practitioner, researcher, finding out something perhaps about the context in which they work, which is not great news for that context. Let's say, for example, they find out that this, you know, whizzy new curriculum thing that's come in is actually having a not great effect on a subset of children, or perceptions of XYZ amongst the pupils are really negative. Obviously, if you're, you know, the pure outsider researcher, you're probably okay with the idea of putting that out there. But if you're actually juggling an insider-outsider perspective and you've found something out that's not great news, you've got a potential dilemma there which involves both ethics and your future employment and your potential, you know, receiving of a P45. So at the risk of turning you into an ethics agony aunt, what would be your advice for somebody that finds themselves on that particular tightrope?
Oh, that's a real tricky one, isn't it? And I think it is something that that is quite you know, problematic. And I, not even necessarily in this particular situation, we hear all the time about research which gets kind of bottom drawed in that it hasn't quite found the thing that it was hoped to do, or that the information that has been gathered doesn't quite match either the sponsor or the research questions that were being asked at the time, which is a real shame, because it means that the research that gets produced and the research that gets published perhaps can give a slightly false sense of where things actually are in the world, and especially when previous research is the very foundation from which future research gets built. I certainly think where something, where the idea of publishing something is going to cause harm somewhere along the lines, then there is a requirement to go and seek discussion and advice further before doing it. Not necessarily because of that it isn't something that needs to be known, but that there is a consideration and a consideredness to what the potentials could be, and make sure that there is a kind of third eye over it as well. And if something is going to be incredibly controversial and somebody is going to be incredibly public with it, then I think making sure that all are aware in advance would also be an ethical requirement, to make sure that people are prepared. But I can't imagine that there is, there's something that in the type of work that we're thinking about here, that you wouldn't be able to talk through and have a discussion with and feel enough and to feel so exposed and alone that you weren't able to just go and talk through ideas with somebody before publishing.
And I'm guessing the answers are going to be similar, but I was interested when Tom was asking that question of the opposite end of that time frame, whereby you might be really curious about something that you have a hunch may or may not be working, that you anticipate perhaps might be a bit controversial to research, but you feel sort of compelled and duty bound to do it. I mean, how do you, should you ask your head? Should you, how far do you go in satisfying those above you and the kind of politics of that you've discussed before you decide, no, I'm going to do this? Is there any advice you'd give to anybody sort of out there who is sort of thinking, is this going to go down well if I research this in my school?
Well, I think... In some cases, there's a kind of level of kind of matter of courtesy. I mean, if you are going to be researching something specific in your school and you're doing your master's and the research that you're doing is very school specific, then there would be a requirement really to let the school know that it was that you are doing it. It would be something that would get picked up in an ethical form anyway. That if you were doing something in the school, that the school were aware and the school has given you approval to do.
That's really sound advice, I think. And I guess we've sort of gone end to end and everything in the middle of this process. You've given us a lot to chew over here. I'm just thinking that the BERA guidelines, they're quite dry. They're really important. But you've obviously found some excellent sources along the way that have got you thinking about ethics in a much more nuanced way, without wanting to put you too much on the spot. Is there any literature out there that is accessible, is interesting, and that sort of will give listeners a new take on this?
Yeah, there's a lot of literature around ethics, and there's a lot of literature that is very much focused around the ethics in practice element, in that, yeah, there is the technical side of completing the form, but there's a remembering that the technical side of completing the form is around setting up for the ethics in practice when you get there. The ethics in practice when you get there is that kind of emotionalness and the uncertainty of what it is that's going to happen. So when you and you design your questions, there's an ethical position of the kind of things that you're asking. But when you actually get there, you have no idea how the participants are going to choose to respond to them, or how they're going to interpret those questions and so on. And so therefore, you just don't know what's going to be coming. And it's recognizing that there's a level of responsiveness and reflexivity that comes in that. There's a paper by Tracy, 2010, which is qualitative quality and the eight big tent criteria, which is a really useful paper on looking at all at these kind of eight aspects of qualitative research, of which ethics is one of them. There's also the Gilliman and Gillam paper from 2004, which is around this distinction between procedural ethics and ethics in practice. And that really was the first paper for me that recognized and acknowledged that these two things coexist. And that really started me on the role of thinking, okay, so the things that I am experiencing are the things which I was always going to experience, but there was no recognition for me at the point of completing the application form that I would be experiencing the dilemmas that I'm experiencing.
You've given both of us lots to think about there, Lisa, and I'm sure to our listeners too. I'm actually about to embark on some participatory research myself, so I'm certainly going to be picking up some of those sources and having a read. So thank you very much for giving us the benefit of your insights and your research. I think you've done your homework. You've got something interesting and something to try for our listeners to consider. And I'm really pleased to say that one of them is drama focused.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was really pleased to be asked, you know, kind of give us something to read or give us something and something to try. So in terms of reading, I would definitely recommend World-Centered Education by Gert Biester. I think it's a really interesting take around thinking about the way that we are, where that we're centering education, especially because there's been a lot of focus about child-centered and curriculum-centered, and he spins and offers an alternative viewpoint on that. So if you do have opportunity to read that, I think it's a really useful thing. And then the thing to try is something called Forum Theatre. Now, this was something that I was exposed to about 6 weeks ago for the very first time. And we were using it in a group tutorial at the University of Dundee. I arrived very cynical. I'm not a drama person, and I was expecting to kind of just sit out at the back and look after the coats, but it was absolutely life-changing in terms of my understanding and the ways that we could use the techniques and the forms of drama to explore some of the issues that I had been exploring kind of in discussion groups and verbally with my tutees, that actually using Forum Theatre allowed us to enact situations and also allowed everyone that was observing to kind of stop and talk about doing things differently, or how people felt at certain points in time, and thinking about the perspectives of other people around the situation that they were acting. It was absolutely fantastic, and I think if anybody could have some opportunity to use it, whether in tutorial time with our university students, and even it then moves into the ways that it could be used in insets, it could be used in teaching in school, it could be used in form time in school. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, life-changing drama pedagogy.
The drama convert to add to the list.
Well, as a science teacher, you really wouldn't. I would not have expected those words to come from me. Six weeks ago.
Drama's reaches wide.
It does indeed.
Well, Dr. Lisa Reed from the University of Dundee, we are very grateful to you for joining us down the line today, and thank you also for persevering with the various technical gremlins that we had over a series of days of line testing. It's turned out well in the end, and it's been a really, really interesting episode, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And anyone that wants to follow you on social media can find you at PhD Indeed on Twitter, now known as X, I believe.
Indeed.
Yeah, PhD indeed. Well, Dr. Lisa Reed, thank you very much. We will be back as ever in 2 weeks' time with another episode. But for now, from Emma and from me, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Dr. Lisa Reed from the University of Dundee. Thanks to Lisa for joining us down the line today. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support by Peter Lamben and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on Twitter at TalkTeachingPod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.